This is Larry Levitt from KaiserNetwork.org. Welcome to Ask the Experts, our regular interactive web show that provides in-depth discussion of current health policy issues and allows you to interact directly with the nation's top policy experts. We've done a number of sessions recently highlighting key elements of state and federal health reform proposals. With many such proposals relying on private insurance as a primary mechanism for delivering health coverage, a major question that emerges is how to provide access to insurance for people with pre-existing health conditions. Some approaches rely on greater regulation of the insurance industry, requiring insurers to take all comers and restricting their ability to charge higher premiums based on an individual's health status. Other proposals, most notably Senator John McCain's, calls for expanded use of so-called state high-risk pools to cover people with pre-existing conditions who are excluded from private insurance plans. These high-risk pools have been around for over three decades, with the first pool created in 1976 in Minnesota. Today they operate in over 30 states. Yet providing coverage to about 200,000 people, they have received only modest attention from the media and policymakers. Today, joined by a panel of state and federal policy experts, we're going to look more closely at how these pools work and at some of the promises and pitfalls to consider in expanding them as part of a health reform package. Karen Politz is a research professor at Georgetown University, where her focus is on the insurance market. Christina Nyquist is managing director of the Office of Policy and Representation at the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association. Doug Stratton is executive director of the Indiana High Risk Pool and also chair of the National Association of State Comprehensive Health Insurance Plans. And Leslie Cummings, joining us by phone from California, is executive director of the Managed Risk Medical Insurance Board, or Mr. MIB, which runs that state's high risk pool. You can reach our panel of experts at any time during the show by emailing your questions to ask@kaisernetwork.org, and we'll try to get to as many of your questions as we can. Thanks to all of you for joining us. And Karen, let's start with you. In the current non-group insurance market, where people buy coverage on their own, in most states, insurers are permitted to underwrite, meaning exclude people based on health conditions or charge higher premiums. How effective do you think high-risk pools, these state high-risk pools, which exist in over 30 states, have been at filling in the gaps in that market?
Well, they haven't reached most of the people who are unable to pass medical underwriting. It's hard to know exactly how many people that may be, but AHIP estimates that were just released recently suggest that about 15% of applicants for underwritten policies are either turned down or charged a highly surcharged premium or have a rider imposed, any of which would make you eligible for a high-risk pool in most of the states. But when you look at the population of pools, maybe it's 1 to 2% of the individual market. In some states, a percent of a percent. In work that I've done over the years with a number of patient groups who've tried through their call centers to refer uninsurable patients to the high-risk pools in their states, more than 90% of the time, people have not been able to get in for a variety of reasons.
And what are some of the reasons people can't get into a high-risk
pool? Well, a leading reason is that in every state that covers the uninsurable with their high-risk pool or offers coverage to the uninsurable, the very condition that made you uninsurable will be excluded as a pre-existing condition, usually for 6 to 12 months. That is a conversation stopper for most people. If you've been diagnosed with cancer, you can't wait 6 months to start treatment. If you have diabetes, you can't not manage your diabetes.
So people start coverage in the pool, but there's an exclusion for that.
Right.
Pre-existing condition.
That's a huge reason. And another reason is that these pools are very expensive. All of them set their premiums at rates above those charged in the private market. And in addition, the age rate, the average pool enrollee is about 50. And the average monthly premium, when you look across all the pools, it's about $600 a month for someone in a $1,000 deductible policy option. So they're very expensive. And then finally, there are a range, depending on the programs that you look at, there are a range of other sort of eligibility restrictions. You have to have lived in state at least a year. You have to be a citizen. You have to have applied for COBRA and exhausted it. So forth. So because of all of those layers of reasons, it can be very, very difficult to actually enroll.
You talked about a range of reasons. I mean, how, with these over 30 states that have risk pools, how homogenous are they? I mean, are they very kind of varied from state to state?
Oh, yeah, they all vary from state to state, but these are common features. Eligibility restrictions, high premiums, and pre-ex exclusions.
Hey, Christina, would you agree with Karen's assessment of how these pools are functioning now?
Well, I think we think that the high-risk pools have actually played a really valuable role in terms of helping many high-risk individuals, many thousands and thousands of high-risk individuals, obtain coverage that they wouldn't have otherwise been eligible for. No system is perfect, and the health insurance is very expensive because the health conditions are very expensive, and if you look at the alternative, for instance, some people look at, say, guarantee issue and community rating, but if you look at states that have done this, for instance, New York, the premiums can be extremely high, and you see people paying premiums of between $900 and $1,600 in the state of New York for health insurance. So while, yes, some high-risk pool premiums are expensive, the alternative is expensive as well. It's also important to recognize that there are high-risk pools out there, depending on your situation, and you can get high-risk pool coverage for $300 a month in some states. There is a wide spectrum. And at the association, what we're really interested in doing is improving high-risk pools. And we think that one way to improve high-risk pools is to have an infusion of federal funds into the high-risk pool community, and that would make health insurance premiums more affordable for those individuals that are applying to high-risk pools.
So is your sense that there's kind of more demand out there than can be satisfied now in the current pools or with current funding?
No, we think that the demand is largely being met in most states, with the exception of, I think, California and Florida. We think the demand is being met, but we think that there would be more demand if the premiums were lower. So, for instance, you know, obviously, if you're only earning X amount per year, even if the high risk pool gives you a fair premium, it's still too expensive for you. So, we're interested in additional subsidies as well.
And from an insurance market perspective, how well are these pools at, let's say, keeping the non-group market, stabilizing the market, or allowing a broader range of insurers to participate in that market? I mean, is there sort of an insurance market stability role that the pools are playing, or playing well or not so well?
Well, we think that the high-risk pools perform an important stopgap function. What's really important to recognize about health insurance is it's like any other insurance. It's important for people to buy the insurance before they actually need it. Because if everyone just waited until they needed insurance to purchase it, then insurance wouldn't be affordable for anyone. And so one of the reasons why we have insurance rules is because for someone who's been buying health insurance for 5 years from us, and they bought coverage before they were sick and so on and so forth, it's not fair to make them pay a much higher rate for someone that actually waited until the last minute to buy insurance. And so that's why we think the high-risk pool performs such an important function, is because for those individuals who find themselves in that situation, there is a stopgap mechanism. There's something to provide them coverage.
And do you have a sense, you talked about an infusion of money potentially helping. Do you have a sense of how much would make a difference? I mean, what's an appropriate
number to
think about?
We're supportive of a 50% federal match for high-risk pool losses, and we think that would help the states leverage their own funds to enhance high-risk pools.
And Karen, you've written some about there's an existing federal grant program for high-risk pools. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about that.
There is an existing program. It was created in 2002. And it's been around for a couple of years. It's been a little intermittently funded by the Congress. So I think there have only been 3 grant awards since the program started. Like any federal grant program, money is allocated according to formula that had a little politics behind it. So it's a small program. It's about $75 million in assistance for all of the pools. But it's allocated unevenly. There are 2 pools out there. Christina mentioned a 50% match. There are 2 pools out there that are fully federally funded by the federal grant program. New Hampshire.
Sorry to put you on the spot with that.
New Hampshire's one. South Dakota or Iowa. It's another little pool. The funding formula is such that it can fund a very high proportion, even more than 100% proportion, actually, of losses in pools if they're very tiny, if they only have a few hundred enrollees. And we do have a couple of pools that are that small. And interestingly, there are some loose requirements about how states can use this money, but there's actually no rule that says that the pools need to be enhanced with the money. And these two state pools continue to be expensive, continue to exclude pre-existing conditions and so forth. So I would agree with Christina, additional funding is absolutely essential. It's not possible to peel off the most expensive layer of people who account for 80-90% of all health care costs and expect states to fund these programs on a shoestring. It's going to be the whole shoe and then some. It's going to be a very expensive program to cover folks like this. And resource constraints are absolutely a part of the problem that needs to be addressed. But I think we also need to look at what is the mission of the pools, and is it to be a source of funding for people who are turned away from private coverage, or and therefore to sort of cover more uncompensated care that would otherwise occur when people are uninsured and sick, or is it to kind of stabilize the market? And I think in many states there's kind of a paradox going on, and states may be trying to satisfy both of these, and at some point they become mutually exclusive. It's hard to create a pool that doesn't look more attractive or that doesn't behave differently than the industry, without the industry feeling like they're at sort of a competitive disadvantage. And so often state pools will decide to behave in ways that are similar to the private market, pre-exing, charging higher premiums and so forth. And that's kind of regrettable. That creates this problem.
Doug, you actually run one of these things in Indiana. Let me bring you in. First, describe how the Indiana pool works. Who gets in it? How's it financed? What kind of coverage it offers?
The program in Indiana is somewhat similar to the programs throughout the country that have high-risk programs. And I take a little bit of an issue with the fact that they're somewhat homogenous other than what their missions are. Because, as Karen mentioned, there's some that are almost exclusively funded through federal funds. There's some that are almost exclusively through state funds. There's others that the insurance industry plays a major role in terms of supporting the programs through appropriations and assessments. And likewise, some of the other issues involving access, eligibility, residency requirements, it is the fact that those exist in each of the states. However, they vary drastically. Indiana, as an example, has a 90-day period of pre-existing conditions. There are others that have greater or lesser. And in terms of how they actually operate, taking Indiana as an example, the mission for that program really dictates how the program operates. And in large measure, it is to be a safety net and provide health insurance coverage for people that can't get in the commercial market because of the very issues we're talking about, and that's the extraordinary high cost of these individuals. When we look at how it's administered, who's eligible, I think virtually every administrator of every state would say we would like very much to be in a position that we could ease the access, we could make it more affordable. There's lots of premium subsidies going on right now, including in the state of Indiana, where we're actually finding funds to help offset the increased cost of premiums. In terms of the population that's in these programs, I think it's really important to underscore the point that was just made. You have such a relatively small percentage of the population that has such an extraordinary impact on the overall health care cost of care in this country. And one of the things that I look at in terms of evaluating public policy kinds of initiatives and healthcare reform is how do you best deal with that?
Can you give us some examples of the kind of people?
An ideal example is the hemophilia population. As an example, there are approximately 54 participants in the Indiana program that have that disease diagnosis. That 54 in 2002 cost the program almost $19 million for 54 individuals. The point that I was driving at was one of the things that I see is an enormous potential for the high-risk programs, not only the stability of the insurance market generally and finding access for people that need this kind of care, but it represents a place where, if adequately funded and the kinds of resources are committed, it will have the opportunity to address high-cost cases like the hemophilia population and can have an enormous impact on what I believe is the real underlying problem in healthcare today, and that's the cost. The example that I started off with the hemophilia population in 2002 cost $19 million, we put a specifically designed disease management program in place. We were able to access 340B pricing, which gives an enormous benefit in terms of pharmaceutical
clinics,
yeah. kinds of services. We worked directly with a treatment center. We brought the cost for that population down to something in the range of about $9 million, a reduction of virtually 50%. It has sustained at that level. There's every reason to believe that we'll continue to do so. There's other programs that are going on throughout the country that are doing the same thing, taking the really high cost conditions and finding ways to provide better outcomes at an earlier opportunity, which will drive down those costs substantially. And I think that's where the real future potential holds for these kinds of programs.
And what would, I mean, Christina and Karen talked about the potential for additional funding. What, in Indiana or other programs around the country, where do you see the need for that funding? What would that funding allow, let's say, your pool or other pools to do?
Well, the first thing it would need to do is it would need to subsidize or reduce the premiums, because truly the cost is a significant impediment to a good number of people, keeping in mind that the people that most need this kind of extraordinary cost and care are likely to be in a position where financially they have already been almost to the point of being devastated. And so the premiums, where it may be affordable to the people on this panel, are not going to be to someone who has had a serious disease condition for an extended period of time. It just simply will suck the resources out.
And how are the premiums set now in the Indiana pool?
The programs across the country are by and large modeled after the model program that the National Association of Insurance Commissioners did, with the thought in mind, let's make these programs be something that really addresses this specific need. It wasn't intended to be a panacea to cure all the problems. The funding mechanism in large measure is based on a calculation that is originally done actuarially by determining what the insurance industry charges are for that area, and then adding a factor to that. And in most instances, it's somewhere in the range of about 150%. We're seeing more and more boards of these high-risk programs, however, saying, you know what, if we do that, we are going to lose the mission that we've set. We are simply not going to serve the people that really need to be served. And as a result, have deliberately said, we can charge up to this amount, but we will not. We simply can't in good conscience continue to charge those rates.
Leslie Cummings from California, let me bring you in. How California pool works a little differently from some of the typical pools around the country. Can you describe some of those differences?
Well, I think the biggest difference is that for most of our history, we have had to maintain a waiting list because we haven't had sufficient funds to subsidize the losses in the pool. Additionally, because of that, our board has created a benefit cap of $75,000. That allows us to serve more people, but it really diminishes the value of the benefit to the person enrolled. And we have the lowest benefit cap in the country. So our struggle here has been to get adequate financing for the pool. I agree with Doug and basically everybody that the cost of coverage here, which is 125% of what the cost would be in the commercial market, is a barrier to people. We did a survey, and significant percentages of the people in our pool are actually fairly low income, They're 18% below $20,000, 25% below $40,000. They're paying a huge percentage of their income for this coverage. In the case of people with incomes under $20,000, 36% of their income for this coverage. So that's our struggle here in California. Now, because of this, our policymakers, as you know, advanced a major health care reform in this last year, which unfortunately didn't go all the way, but Governor Schwarzenegger proposed a totally different approach to having a high-risk pool in his proposal, which was that there be guaranteed issuance, that there be rules about rating, and that there be an individual mandate. The purpose of that was to bring in enough healthy risk to offset the high risk of people who had medically uninsurable conditions.
Well, Leslie, I didn't plan it this way, but one of our first email questions we have from the audience is about exactly this issue, about whether to compare the long-term financial viability for key stakeholders for a high-risk insurance pool approach versus mandatory community rating. And Christina, let me turn to you. You talked about this a little bit in states like New York that do have guarantee issue and community rating in the non-group market. How do you see the distinction between, let's say, relying on high-risk pools versus, let's say, moving the market more towards guaranteed access and community rating or eliminating health status rating?
Sure. Well, in a state that requires guaranteed issue, basically you have, let's say, your individual market subscribers or this pool, then if you have guaranteed issue, your very high-risk individuals, essentially, what you're saying is we're going to have this pool of individual market subscribers be the source of subsidy for these very high-risk individuals. And that's how guarantee issue works. With a high-risk pool, what essentially you're saying is we have some very high-risk people and we need to take care of them. But instead of just making our little pool of individual market subscribers subsidized as individuals, we're going to create a high-risk pool and we're going to pull broad subsidies from different sources, hopefully some from the federal government, from tobacco taxes in some states, general revenues, from the broader insurance pool, from assessments on self-funded plans. And we're going to ask all those different broad-based financers to help subsidize those very high-risk individuals. That's the primary difference between guaranteed issue and the high-risk pool, we see.
And Karen, how about from your perspective, how would you think about the distinction between, let's say, an insurance market reform approach versus relying on high-risk pools as a safety?
I mean, Christina's right. One way or the other, a subsidy needs to be delivered, and that's what insurance does. Even if you pluck off the top 15% of people, whoever remains in your individual market pool is involved in a cross-subsidy because some of them aren't making claims and a few of them are. So I think there's no question that there needs to be a subsidy. I guess the question is how best to deliver that. Is there a more efficient way and is there a more politically palatable way? Either way could work. There's nothing wrong, I think, with the notion of high-risk pools, and Doug and Christine are absolutely right. These pools do provide life-saving coverage to the people. I have a friend who's covered in the high-risk pool who's getting treatment for her cancer that just wouldn't be happening otherwise. So it's incredibly important that we find a way to do it. But I do think sometimes we get a little lost in the weeds and we lose track of sort of how the subsidies are actually working. And we look for ways to sort of mask some of the costs or not pay attention to some of the costs or hope that some of them won't need to be subsidized in either market, in either approach. Either way I think can work. The one thing I would say about the pools and going back to this kind of notion that they've got two missions, one is to be a safety net for the uninsurable and the other is to sort of find a way to stabilize the market. That is absolutely a trade-off that is in the eye of the beholder. And I think the way that pools have been governed traditionally in most states, they've taken a very kind of conservative approach and a very pro-industry approach to weighing decisions and deciding what can I do to cover more people or to make coverage more affordable and what can I do to make sure that the industry isn't negatively impacted. In my own state, I actually served on the board of the high-risk pool where I live for a couple of years, and that state took a kind of unique approach, at least for a while. They've since kind of gone back to the traditional way, but first of all, they collected some very explicit data. In the state of Maryland, all carriers need to report regularly, quarterly, on how many applications they get, how many they deny, how many they charge more, and so forth. And so you can see how many uninsurable people were there in this state in April. And then you can compare that to how many applied to the pool. And when the pool was sort of being conservative on the side of how are we going to subsidize, and they pre-axed and they had high premiums and high cost sharing and so forth, 1,200, 1,500 people a month were being denied coverage in the individual market and maybe 50. We're coming to the pool. They tried an experiment and relaxed all of those constraints. And the industry folks said, no, people will wait. They'll wait until they get sick to buy coverage, and they won't buy from us anymore. And we said, well, let's just see. If they do, we'll stop. And so we relaxed all those things. And all of a sudden, several hundred people a month were coming to the pool. The applications in the individual market stayed steady. They never moved a blip. They never moved. So some of it, I think, when we sort of think about these different ways of subsidizing, we need to ask ourselves, are we about subsidizing or are we about protecting profitability of the industry? And this notion of people waiting until they get sick, I think, is perhaps a little incorrect. It's absolutely true you need to worry about selection, but people don't wait until they get sick. People wait until they lose their coverage. People lose a job, they get divorced, they turn 19, and they lose their coverage. And usually at that point, they're in trouble with other reasons. They have trouble paying other bills, and they have trouble paying for their medical care. The uninsured have trouble paying for their medical care. So it's not like these folks who need high-risk pool coverage are out there waiting, you know, gaming the system, spending their trust fund on BMWs instead of participating in the insurance system. That's really not the problem that we're trying to address. We have a lot of uninsured people who are sick who just can't afford. They just can't afford to contribute much, and they'd be willing to contribute something, but we can't keep sort of piling these other penalties on them because it makes them go away. And that's why there isn't a waiting list in most other states. California is at least honest about it. They say, this is all we have, rats. It's not enough, and so there's a waiting list. There isn't a waiting list in other states. They don't need a waiting list because people can't come in.
Why can't they come in? Because?
Because of all of these sort of other things that restrict the subsidy that needs to be out there. So I just think we need to be more explicit about what the subsidy costs. If it's going to be in the private market, great. People are going to need more subsidies to help with that. If it's going to be in a public program, fine. In some ways, better. It's more accountable. But let's be real about what the cost is, and let's finance it. Let's not kid ourselves and make some of it disappear off the balance sheets, because those are real people.
Let me bring you in. Christina, would you see this, the trade-off, similarly to Karen?
No. Karen and I have worked many times together, and I think we all have the same objective. I mean, we all want more people to have coverage, and affordability is a challenge, and the question is, you know, how do you maintain the balance to keep it affordable? And the reason why we believe in high-risk pools is, although we do think that there needs to be additional funds and we would support enhancing the high-risk pools, we think that's a preferred approach to guaranteed issue because of the concern about adverse selection. And I know that's a wonky term, but essentially, you know, the concern is that, you know, if individuals can buy coverage at any point in time, it's the old, if you can wait until your house is burning to buy property insurance, then all property insurance will be much more expensive. And so we think this is a good way to keep the prices manageable for the vast majority of people who are buying health insurance coverage. We're very supportive of laws like HIPAA, which basically say that if you lose your job and you need to buy coverage, that you can't be pre-exed. The high-risk pool can't pre-ex you. The high-risk pool would have to take you right away.
So the waiting periods we were talking about earlier wouldn't apply to someone who's continuously insured, but someone who's buying insurance for the first time, they would.
Right.
Someone
who's continuously insured would not face a pre-ex in a high-risk pool. If they're in a fallback state, they wouldn't face a pre-ex in the individual market. So we're supportive of those types of provisions that protect those that are continuously insured, and we want to continue to work at the Blues to enhance high-risk mechanisms so that they can face the affordability problem that we're having.
Just a minor point, HIPAA eligibles are just a tiny subset of people who were continuously insured. You have to be continuously insured for a period of time, you have to have been coming out of a group policy, and you have to have elected an exhausted COBRA. In other states, you can have been continuously insured under an individual policy and come to the high-risk pool and still face a pre-ex. You can have come off the Medicaid program and come to the high-risk pool and still face a pre-ex. You can have come out of a group policy and not elected COBRA, just hoping to go straight into the pool. You can't do it. So it's, you know, so all I'm saying is pay attention to the details. It is very easy in our system, because the rules are so many and so complex, for people to have a break in coverage. Almost 40% of our population will have at least a small break in coverage at some point over a 3-year period. I mean,
and once again,
it's hard not to.
With regard to HIPAA, you can have a break in coverage up to 63 days, and as long as your break in coverage isn't more than 63 days, you are guaranteed access. And for those employers that don't have COBRA coverage, they can bypass the COBRA requirement and go straight into the guaranteed mechanism, and if that's the high-risk pool, it's the high-risk pool. High-risk pools do vary, as Doug mentioned earlier, and there are high-risk pools that credit all prior coverage, and there are some, for instance, the state of Alabama is completely focused on HIPAA eligibles, but there are other high-risk pools that do credit all prior coverage.
Well, I want to turn back to financing a bit. We've gotten a lot of questions about that, which is not unusual for a healthcare discussion. And one, just ask the panelists to talk about the varying financing approaches in the different states. And Leslie, let me start with you in California. As a state with a waiting list, I mean, you mentioned there being insufficient funding and that generating the need for a waiting list.
Yes.
How is the pool financed?
In our state, the pool is financed by state dollars. The subsidy is financed by state dollars, and so it's 63% is paid for by subscribers, and the remainder is paid for by state dollars. That is unusual in the country. Most pools are financed with some variation of insurer fees or insurer fees plus a tax credit, but that has not been the way here.
And is there an annual discussion about how much state dollars to put into the pool?
Actually, the source of the dollars that is used is tobacco tax dollars, which is a declining revenue source. So we will actually be getting less money next year than we have this year.
And Doug, how about in Indiana? What's the financing source?
Similar to California, there is a premium that's charged that represents something in the range of about 51% of the total revenue that's necessary. The balance is made up, 75% is picked up through the general appropriations by the state of Indiana, and the balance then is assessed to the insurance industry on the basis of the same relativity that their premiums are to the total premiums in the state. There is no tax credit that's given. Essentially, the state's perspective on that is that's kind of the cost of doing business in the state of Indiana. You need to help fund and support these kinds of programs. And I'd like, if I could, for just a second,
sure,
to go back to an issue that was raised that I think really deserves some attention. And that's the issue of all the regulations and all the restrictions and requirements, not only with the high-risk programs, but HIPAA and all of the other programs that have kind of formed the network and fabric, if you will, of the current healthcare system. I think there's some enormous problems and therefore opportunities in cleaning up some of this, making this process much more transparent, much smoother, working together much, much better. However, in doing so, and looking at this as objectively as I'm able, and when I look at various policies from various organizations and parties, I try to look at it, what's the right solution? What should we be doing and how should we be doing it? One of the concerns that I have today that has an impact on that is this very issue of guaranteed issue versus a high-risk kind of program. I am concerned about messing with the industry right now, to be candid. As I look at what's happening in the general economy and the problems that we have with the automobile industry and airline industry and lots of other industries, I think, you know what, if we start messing with the health insurance industry and healthcare generally, there's the potential for lots of issues. And that's not, you know, being an extremist. But as I thought about the policies and I thought about our discussion today, that issue became one of the things that I thought, you know, I think we need to be looking at incremental kinds of changes, but it has to be done with the thought in mind. We have to start eliminating a lot of the barriers, a lot of the duplications, a lot of avoidable cost, administrative things. And I think that would lend itself, along with the idea of finding programs we can really address the highest cost cases and do it with the focus of if you find the best outcomes at the earliest time, you will bring real cost savings to the industry generally.
May weigh in here?
Sure, Leslie.
Leslie from California. You know, we viewed this, our governor and the leadership in the legislature viewed this really very differently here when we were contemplating health care reform. everybody talks about the need to bring in subsidy when you're covering high-risk people, but the mechanism that California looked to do that is to bring in low-risk people who are not now covered. So in the context of a comprehensive reform, our policymakers rejected the idea of a pool and said it is far, far better for medically uninsurable people to be able to get coverage like everybody else, and you just have to make sure that you have a good risk mix in the market via the individual mandate for people to get coverage. Another thing that I just wanted to mention is, you know, in our pool, we had, in the last year that we did a fact book, 20% of our subscribers never filed a claim for anything in the year. And the bulk of our costs cluster around below $5,000 per year. So what this means is these pools exist in an environment, and the environment is specific to each state. And that environment is the rules of the individual market. Here in California, there are no rules. There's no specific rejection rates, no standard underwriting criteria, no rules about rating. And you have to look at pools in that context.
Well, I'm pretty sure we could probably stay here for the rest of the hour and debate comprehensive health reform and community rating in the non-group market. I've done that before, actually.
Yes.
Let me turn back to some of the specifics of the pools. And we had a question, and Doug talked about this earlier, about case management or disease management within the pools. The question was whether high-risk pools have been having any success with these types of approaches or approaches to get the costs down. And Leslie, let me stay with you. I mean, would you how would you characterize some of the approaches that Mr. Mib Pool in California have taken around managing high-cost cases?
Well, the approaches that our pool takes, we are different in that we contract with several different plans, and we rely on the disease management strategies of that particular plan. So there is variation in the approaches used, and that's way different than Doug, who is using one provider network or one, you know, plan, so he can see what exactly is going on. So I don't have the data on what happens plan by plan.
And Doug, in Indiana, the pool itself, are you taking an active role in putting in place programs to manage high-cost cases?
We are, and in fact, we are the driver of that. We have designed them. We're in the process now of implementing another for AIDS and HIV. We have about 1,200 in our program. And we go to the provider network that works in that area. We say, if you'd start off with a clean sheet of paper, what's the idea? What's the gold standard in terms of providing care? And where should we be investing our resources in terms of finding solutions and improving outcomes? We then manage that ourselves. It's not turned over to a vendor. They're very driven on the basis of what our specific population and demographics needs are. And that's what we'll continue to do as we find other opportunities.
And how would you compare, let's say, the what you do to what a typical private insurer might do in this area?
Well, I need to add, Indiana has a provision that was inserted in its statute about 3 years ago that makes participation in disease management programs in the state mandatory. That was not without a lot of political debate and pushing, and perceived by a lot of people as a pretty draconian approach. I can tell you it has had an enormous impact. To require people in a program that's supported by public funds to do the things that need to be done to help take care of their care makes absolute sense to me. And I don't have much reluctance at all of saying, if you are in this program and you have one of those disease conditions, for example, hemophilia or HIV positive, you have an obligation to help us with the resources of this state. And part of that is to adhere to the kinds of programs that we put in place. In doing that, what we've essentially done is we've said, we're going to find exactly what needs to be done with this particular population, and we're driven and directed by what's the best possible outcome and the best care we can provide. And we genuinely believe that that's the least expensive overall, to do it right the first time.
We also had a number of questions about the the actual benefits or terms of coverage in the pools and how it affects people with expensive illnesses. One from the Hemophilia Foundation about caps on coverage. The other asking about how pool coverage would serve the needs of someone with some traumatic brain injuries. And Karen, you've looked a lot at the pools across states. I mean, what's your sense of how that coverage compared to, let's say, coverage in the private market deals with people with these very expensive illnesses, which are the population it's covering?
Typically, high-risk pool coverage is far, far more comprehensive than what you would be able to buy in the private individual market. That coverage seems to decline every year. So certainly there are exceptions. There are pools that drastically limit, a few pools that drastically limit, for example, prescription coverage. Mental health, not all pools cover maternity care. So some of the sort of benefit coverage weaknesses that you see in private industry will also appear in pools. But for the most part, I think the benefits are quite comprehensive. The one thing that has... trend that has been growing in pools is that the cost sharing has been going up. And because of this sort of trade-off, how can we make premiums affordable and, you know, still provide adequate coverage? Increasingly, you're seeing pools now that offer deductible options of $5,000 a year, $10,000 a year. There's one pool that has a $25,000 a year limit on out-of-pocket max as one of the options. You know, if you have hemophilia, you need to factor that in because you're going to hit all those deductibles and maximums. So in addition to the $600 a month you're paying for your premium, you may be paying another $25,000 out of pocket for the expenses. And that's hard. I think that's very hard for folks. The vast, vast majority now of high-risk pool enrollees have a deductible of $1,000 a year or higher.
How about paying that? The benefit cap that Leslie talked about in California, $75,000 cap on benefits, is that a common?
No, she's right. That's the lowest. That's the lowest one out there. I think Wyoming has, I can't do this all from memory, but a couple $100,000 a year annual cap in one of their pool options. Mostly you don't see that, annual cap options. You do see lifetime limits in pools, and most folks won't stay long enough to hit the lifetime limit, but, you know, and that's true in private coverage, too. But for select populations, hemophilia is certainly one, people with organ transplants, you know, who will consistently have claims in excess of $100,000 a year, that's who gets hurt by those.
Larry?
Yeah, Leslie?
So what our board did was different than establishing high deductibles. An idea that, you know, is kind of an odd one for a population that you consider to be high risk, but they provided a benefit cap. So we have a low deductible. It's $500, but we have this benefit cap. And I will tell you that a person from the Hemophilia Society in California came and talked to me and said, we want to be able to get coverage through your pool, but we cannot, you know, go there when you have a $75,000 benefit cap. And that benefit cap has kept us from getting any federal funds because the rule is it has to be, your coverage has to be like that is available in the market, and there is no coverage in California with that kind of a cap.
And is that something you've talked about revisiting, this balance between the deductible and a cap?
We did. We had a big, long think about our benefit design about 9 months ago. And the board really wanted to lift the benefit cap, but we realized that the people who would have to pay for it would be the subscribers because we're not getting any more subsidy money, and that would therefore make their coverage even less affordable to them than it is now. So that the board did establish the $500 deductible at that time, but decided that we had to wait to revisit the benefit cap until the day came that we got some additional subsidy dollars from somewhere.
The association is supporting two initiatives.
I'm sorry, I did not mean to interrupt.
I thought you were finished.
No, I'm done.
I was going to say, we're supporting two initiatives to try to address these issues. The first I've mentioned already, which is a federal match for high-risk pools losses. But the second is what we call the percent of income tax credit. And that is, if an individual was going to a high-risk pool, for instance, and the high-risk pool premium that was quoted was above a certain threshold of their income, say more than 7% of their income or something like that, then they would qualify for a special federal tax credit. So people could feel comfortable that they're not going to face more than 7% of their income to be paid for the high-risk pool premiums.
And that would apply just to high-risk pool coverage?
I would just like to add that if that standard were adopted here, basically virtually our entire pool would get subsidized because you don't hit 7% of income until you reach $60,000 a year for someone.
So, and maybe that would be fine. You know, I think the idea behind the percent of income tax credit is that there are people of moderate means who, when they're faced with a high-risk pool premium, it's very unaffordable, even with all the backdoor subsidies that the high-risk pool has built into place.
So, we had a number of questions about this issue of affordability. I mean, one from an economist in South Carolina who also happens to be in the high-risk pool there, whose premium for coverage for her alone is $16,000 annually. And another from West Virginia, from the Office of the Insurance Commissioner, asking if any states provide any subsidies for low-income subscribers. And are any of you aware of states that do subsidize high-risk pool coverage?
Indiana does, along with a growing number of states. I think, in fact, if you did a quick survey, you'd probably find out of the 34 that are in operation today, probably at least 25 either are or in the process of putting something together to help subsidize those people that are at least able to afford the care.
I think a number of states use the availability of those federal grants to initiate a low-income subsidy program.
But in many, and it's true, the number of programs has been growing. I wasn't aware it was that high, but that's good news. In many states, though, the low-income subsidy is a discount. It's not what you might typically think of, what I typically think of, as a low-income subsidy. So in many states, the subsidy is to take away the premium surcharge that Doug mentioned. Instead of charging 150% of standard rates, they'll just take it back to 100%, which works out to about a one-third discount, which is something, but if that brings your premium from $1,000 a month down to $600, that's still, and that subsidy is limited to people who are in poverty, then obviously that's not enough. Doug, I think your program, I might be mistaken, I always mix up my states, but haven't you sort of also joined your Medicaid program and sort of found a way to subsidize some populations?
Yes,
the
state of Indiana has put a program in place this year, Healthy Indiana Program, specifically targeted and designed to help subsidize in a very substantial way those that are unable to afford health care. And the concept is very innovative as far as I can see. What they do is there has been an increase in the cigarette tax that funds this program. As part of the administration's concept, the program funds are then used to promote programs that help smoking cessation kinds of initiatives but in addition then siphons off a good portion of those funds to be used to pay premiums for anyone that's 200% or less than the federal poverty level.
Is that the full premium?
In most instances it is being applied to the full premium. In some instances, however, it can be up to 5% of what the annual income is for the family, but that's a ceiling. And what we're seeing in terms of the actual enrollment, a substantial percentage of the people are paying nothing. It is part of a Medicaid extension program. There has been an enormous amount of energy and effort that went into that, and it's having some real impact. We're seeing substantial enrollment, and we're getting the kind of impact that I think people were looking for, and that is we are actually taking a lot of people off the uninsured list that there's no way they could have afforded coverage under any other circumstances.
And are you getting enrollees aren't pre-exed either, right?
That's correct.
Yeah.
And are you getting federal matching funds for that as part of the Medicaid?
There is. As a result of it being part of a Medicaid state plan amendment, there is some additional funding that comes from the federal government. And those kinds of initiatives, what we're finding is in a lot of states, they're starting to look at innovative ways to address the issues, and I think we're starting to see some things come out of those efforts that are really producing some sustainable results.
I want to sort of broaden the discussion a little bit. We had a question about, we've talked a lot about how to subsidize or the appropriate way to subsidize people in the non-group market and provide stability to that market. We also had a question about whether, it's right to frame subsidies in this way. I'll read the question. We seem to be using high-risk pools to protect an individual insurance market, wherein premiums are based on benefits provided to a healthier population. Other nations, even if using private insurers, are more effective in distributing risk equitably by basing contributions more on income levels than the actuarial value of the benefits offered. Is there any reason that this concept would not work in the United States? Christina, let me start with you. I mean, is it your personal perspective, the association's perspective? I mean, is it right for people to be paying different amounts based on their actuarial risk? Would it make more sense to move to a system where people are paying more based on income?
Well, I think what's really important to recognize is a couple things, one of which is there's a very important rule in the individual market, and it's called guaranteed renewability, which is once you actually buy individual market health insurance coverage, the insurer can't cancel you because you get sick. And so when you actually look at our individual market pool, the health status is, there's plenty of sick people, very sick people, in our individual market health insurance pool, but they're very sick people that purchase coverage before they got sick. And so I think that there's a real misperception that there aren't sick people with individual market coverage. There are very sick people with individual market coverage, but they bought the coverage largely before they faced their illness. So, and to go back to the original question, the notion of guaranteed issue and community rating, it has been tried in states, and it isn't a magic solution to the cost problem. In New York, the community rated guarantee issue premium is between $900 and $1,600 per month for an individual. In New Jersey, it's between $1,200 and $2,300 a month for an individual. So, once again, cost is a problem, and it's important for us to take hold of that. But the concern with guaranteed issue is what happens is the lower risk individuals that are young and healthy, they say, I'm not going to buy coverage. And once they leave, they take their subsidy with them, and there's no one to subsidize the sicker individuals.
And do you think that it would be more workable, let's say, with an individual requirement to buy coverage, like was proposed, Leslie talked about in California?
The individual mandate is sort of an interesting question. And the question we have is, many states, for instance, require automobile insurance and have auto mandates, and yet you still see double-digit uninsured auto-insured rates. And so we question whether or not just having an individual mandate would actually result in 100% coverage, because you still have the affordability problem. And just because the government's mandating it doesn't mean that people are going to be able to afford to buy it.
Well, we do have a living example of this in Massachusetts, and I think conventional wisdom is that they're doing a pretty good job of eliminating the uninsured there.
Well, I a couple things. One is, once again, Massachusetts has done some very innovative reforms. They built those reforms based on a market that had been guaranteed issue, community rated, for eternity. It was not a new reform, and so it did not create any market dislocations because of that. Second of all, is that they still don't have an uninsurance rate that's zero. Certainly they've made progress in the first year, but they don't have an uninsurance rate that's zero. And what I think you were talking about was doing guaranteed issue in a new state without a history of guaranteed issue, and whether or not that could be workable.
I just think it's important to separate out, there are two parts, two functions that are going on when we talk about subsidizing. The majority of us, literally the majority of us in the United States, only account for about 3% of all healthcare spending. For most of us, we spend a couple hundred bucks a year on healthcare. And the majority of healthcare spending is accounted for by only 5% of the population. So either we spend a couple hundred bucks a year or a couple hundred thousand dollars a year. When you set premiums that begin to reflect the actuarial value, you are saying explicitly, we're not going to do that, or we're not going to do that completely. We're just going to say to the sick people, sorry, you're on your own for more of it. All of us are parents. The year that our children were born, if we were priced actuarially, we would have paid for the delivery of that baby. That doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense in terms of what people can afford practically, given what incomes are, and it doesn't make sense in terms of public health. I mean, we want people to be covered so they can go in and have their babies in a healthy, you know, good healthcare setting. We want people with hemophilia to get their clotting factor. So whether it's through a public program that spreads it or through an insurance market, I think we expect that kind of cross-subsidy and we need it. Otherwise, only Bill Gates could ever afford to pay for his health insurance. None of the rest of us could when we are sick, when we need to use it. The other subsidy is when you sort of average healthcare costs, per capita spending is $7,000 a year. That's more than a lot of families can spend. It is. So we need additional subsidies based on ability to pay. And the uninsured overwhelmingly have very low incomes, but even the median income in this country is only about $45,000. So middle class families also need some help paying for health insurance that even has this kind of perfect cross-subsidization going on in New York and New Jersey. They still need help. What you don't see in the state of New York and New Jersey, but you do see in Massachusetts, at least for some of the population, is, you know, both parts. You see the cross-subsidy so that we all sort of pay an average health expense, and then you see additional income subsidies in Massachusetts, at least for people up to the median income, to help them afford that even premium. And we really need to do both. And as long as we keep doing one or the other, it's whether through a pool or through the market, it's going to work imperfectly.
I just wanted to make sure, clarify one thing, and that is, in the individual market, when you first apply for coverage, you are underwritten and people evaluate your health status. And then you're given a rate. And when you apply with your healthy, you get, you know, a tier one rate and you pay the standard. And if the next year you then develop cancer, your rate doesn't go up because you develop cancer. You still have the tier one rate. That's the way individual market coverage generally works. So when we talk about health status rating, and there are all these sort of yucky, horrible things to talk about, what we're really talking about is we don't want to keep people from getting coverage, but what we want to do is not penalize the people that purchased coverage before they got sick that are also struggling to buy health insurance coverage. The money has to come from somewhere. And once again, the reason why we've been very supportive of high-risk pools is rather than say that those, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars to subsidize very high-risk individuals should just come from this little individual market pool, what we're saying is, no, let's leave that little individual market pool alone and let's take broad subsidies from general revenues, tobacco taxes, all these other different sources, and use those to subsidize a high-risk pool where individuals that are sick can get health insurance coverage, and combined with a percent of income tax credit to make it affordable on the front end.
Christina, I don't know what insurance market you're familiar with when you're talking about guaranteed renewal, but to my knowledge, I mean, there are no rules here in California about what an insurer could charge somebody even though they're renewing the product.
Once again, in the vast majority of states, the way the individual market works is if you have health insurance coverage and you get sick and you're renewed, you do not get shifted into a different tier because you got sick. Now, there's always trend, which is applied to everyone, but in terms of whether or not you were being charged more because you got sick, in the vast majority of markets, that is not happening. And Blue Cross Blue Shield plans are not doing that.
Well, I'm pretty sure we could spend a whole another hour on this one as well. Unfortunately, we're coming to the end of this one. Let me just jump in with a clarification through the wonders of the Internet. Someone from CMS wrote in to say that six of the CMS-funded high-risk pools use their federal grants to provide low-income premium subsidies, and others do so through state funding. So a virtual panelist. we are coming to the end of the hour. And, I mean, as I said at the start, Senator John McCain, the presumptive nominee for president from the Republican Party, has featured high-risk pools as a major part of his health care reform plan. I want to close by asking all of you to talk about, you know, sort of comprehensive reform, market reform aside, you know, what are the couple things we could do now to improve high-risk pools, either at the state level or at the federal level? Karen, let me start with you. I mean, what are some things that could be done to improve the functioning of these pools right now?
Well, one very simple, straightforward thing would be to just have more careful reporting on what goes on in the pools, how they operate. The High Risk Pool Association actually publishes a terrific book every year that summarizes a lot of information about these programs, which is very useful. And it would be helpful to have parallel information about how the individual market works, that is sort of shedding risk into these pools, a lot more reporting about underwriting practices so we could get a better idea of who's out there, who needs help, who, and then we could evaluate how they are, how they aren't. More resources certainly is going to be an important way for these pools to be stronger. I think attention to the barriers of availability, affordability, and adequacy of coverage, with particular attention to the pre-ex exclusions, would help a number of people who would like to avail themselves of help from these pools to be able to get in. And I think taking a look at pool governance is also important. Most of these decisions are made by, some are set in statute, but most are then made on a day-to-day basis by governing boards. And when you look at who runs these pools, in many states, the dominant interest represented on the board is the very insurance industry that gets taxed more if more people get in. So I think we need to pay attention to that.
And Christina, you talked about the proposals for federal matching funds for tax credits. What are the couple things you would like to see to improve the workings or the functioning of the pools right now?
Well, those two things I think are just really critical because they both are addressing the cost problem on the back end for the high-risk pools, so they can do things like make sure the offerings are market-based offerings, and on the front end to make sure the individuals can afford it based on their income. And the third thing is just to make sure that pools are doing what Indiana has been doing, which is to pull the innovative case management and disease management practices that have been developed in the employer-based system to make sure that those are being applied in the high-risk pool as well.
Doug?
Well, I'll go back to points that have been made throughout, and that is, in large measure, the issue was the cost of care. And as I look at and I think about what can we do to improve the circumstances, what can we do to improve the operation of high-risk programs, whatever we could do to begin to take advantage of the resources that are available through a myriad of locations to find the best practices, to find the place that can focus on this very small percentage of the population. And whether it's done through what currently is the design of a high-risk program or some other program, the logic that's behind the idea of focusing on this very small percentage of the population that so drive the cost makes absolute sense, and it's probably the most important piece of finding how to deal with this cost piece.
And Leslie, we'll close with you, and I'll ask you a slightly different question. With the failure of the health reform plan in California earlier this year, what should we expect over the next 6 months to a year in California and any debate there that might affect the running of the pool?
Well, Governor Schwarzenegger remains committed to doing the big thing. People are having conversations, but as you may know, we have a terrible, terrible budget problem here. So there are conversations going on between the administration and the legislature about what first steps can we take that would establish a good foundation for the long run, and then we hope to return to the bigger issue when we're back on our feet financially.
I think we'll leave it there. I'm Larry Levitt, and you've been watching KaiserNetwork.org. Thanks to you for joining us, to our panel, and we'll see you next time for Ask the Experts.